Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Vance Rader. This is episode 121. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, eVooks, YouTube, my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com. The episode section has a link to my podcast page, and it'll be on libertarianinstitute.org in the podcast and the blog section. I want to remind you about my books, The Kids Are Not All Right and Freedom Through Memedom. They are available on Amazon. They are also available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. And there you can buy them for cryptocurrency only. Today I want to talk about current events. I got a couple articles that are a good example of the government overreaching, the state doing just insanely evil things. So I invited my friend Dean to come on. We're going to talk about these articles. He has a couple articles he wants to talk about. So, Dean, I got this article in front of me. Everybody's been talking this week. I mean, I'm really sick to death of, I don't know about you, but immigration.
Oh, yeah. No, it's freaking everywhere, and it's annoying the hell out of me because, largely because I'm seeing a lot of people who are, like, libertarians or anarchists or whatever, who are, like, sort of, I guess, leaving principles by the wayside because of some of this. It's really messing with people's heads.
Yeah, well, this one's different, okay? This article is different because I still wanted to bring this up, but let's talk about something really fucked up within this, okay? And the title of the article goes like this. Immigrant children forcibly injected with psychotropic drugs under Obama and Trump. Lawsuit being filed.
Wait a minute. Fucking MK Ultra style shit? Is that what you're talking about?
Let me read the article, okay? All right. A federal lawsuit filing on April 23rd is an ongoing class action lawsuit revealed that immigrant children separated from their parents during both Obama and Trump administrations were allegedly held down and forcibly injected with powerful psychiatric drugs while being held at the Shiloh Treatment Center, a government contractor south of Houston that houses undocumented immigrant minors. There's a link here to the lawsuit, too. I actually went over and started reading it. The children in sworn affidavits described how they were told the drugs were vitamins and that they would not be allowed to see their parents or leave the facility unless they complied and took medications. One child recalled being forced to take pills, which they were told were vitamins, in the morning, at noon, and night, stating, "The staff told me that some of the pills are vitamins because they think I need to gain weight. The vitamins changed about two times, and each time I felt different." An investigation by Reveal for the Center for Investigative Reporting found that one child was prescribed 10 different shots and pills during the including the antipsychotic drugs Latuda, Geodon, and olanzapine, the Parkinson's medication benztropin, the seizure medications clonazepam and divalproex, the nerve pain medication and antidepressant duloxetine, and the cognition enhancer guanfacine. One child described being thrown against a door and choked by a supervisor until she passed out for trying to open a window. The supervisor told me I was going to get a medication injection to calm me down. The girl said two staff grabbed me and the doctor gave me the injection despite my objection and left me there on the bed. The Shiloh facility is one of 71 companies contracted by the federal government to house and supervise immigrant children that have been deemed unaccompanied minors. The investigation by Reveal found that in the last 4 years, nearly $1.7 billion was paid out to contractors with serious allegations levied against them for mistreating children. And one of the tweets that they link to here says, a 10-year-old boy we're calling Jose was sent to a residential medical center in Texas alone. He told his lawyer he was physically assaulted there multiple times. He describes the facility's school and hospital as simply trailers. Despite the extremely serious allegations of child abuse being reported at these facilities, the federal government continued to utilize the same companies to house undocumented immigrant children. The records were filed in connection with an ongoing class action status lawsuit alleging poor treatment of undocumented immigrant children in U.S. custody going back to 2013 under the Obama administration. And it notes, it's important to note that the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy was announced on April 6th. Thus, the allegations in the lawsuit took place prior to the implementation of treating illegal border crossings as a criminal infraction. So basically this all was going down before it was changed that this would be considered criminal.
What I'm hearing when you're reading that is that they are giving these kids nervous system inhibitors, like almost like I've got a family member who has Tourette's syndrome, and way back in the day, they used to give basically an inhibitor that would just stop the function of the body. It would just, she was bedridden because of it, and not active in her life. It seems like they are just basically sedating these kids.
What I went in the early 2000s, I was going to, a friend of mine was over in Romania, and they were doing work building housing for the, there was a huge orphan epidemic after caused by a lot of Ceausescu's policies. And what they used to do was, a lot of the kids, especially the infants, were just left in cribs and never held, nurtured, or anything. And the older kids, they were just basically tied to a bed. And the way this sounds to me like is, instead of tying them to a bed, which is, you know, bad optics, they sounds like they're doing the next best thing by, you know, rendering them
inoperable.
I mean, non-functional
is that the word? Yeah, that's fucking horrifying. I have to say, it doesn't surprise me. This is exactly the kind of thing that we would expect from government, but at the same time, man, that's horrifying. I can't imagine being in a situation where you're forced to be sedated like that. That's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it says here, is one of the last paragraphs says, the Shiloh facility has been synonymous with mistreating children since December 2014, when Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a complete lunatic, called for Shiloh to be shut down, citing reports from the Houston Chronicle of physical violence, unreasonable and excessive use of physical restraints, administering emergency medications without notice to government authorities, and several deaths of minor children while in custody.
This sounds like old school child prisons. Like if you listen to the last podcast on the left, they talk about some of these people who were some serial killers and stuff who were kept in juvenile prisons. And this sounds a lot like the kind of shit that went on back in the 1930s and 40s in juvenile prisons. You said this is run by a private organization, like this is contracted. It's not run by like DHS or the DOJ.
Yeah, it's not a government facility. It's a private, it's a quote unquote private facility, but obviously they're a government contractor.
Of course. That's horrific. And it doesn't surprise me at all that this kind of thing would happen, but it is terrifying. I had thought that this kind of treatment would have gone out of fashion, but, that's terrifying.
I will tell you this from personal experience. The state loves to administer, antipsychotics and goofball, you know, that turns you into mush. I had a friend that got caught up in the sovereign citizen, that whole thing.
Yeah, that movement.
But he was nonviolent. I mean, he had a house. He decided he didn't want to pay for electricity anymore.
Right.
And he, you know, got generators and everything like that. And he realized that they were still, even though he had turned everything off, he was still generating power. that they were still going to charge him for power. So he decided to mess with the government equipment to try and disconnect it completely. And they ended up arresting him. And when he started to go into his, you know, into his constitutional stuff and you don't have power over me, they threw him in a mental facility. And for 6 months in a row, every single day, they just shot him. They shot him up with drugs that made him drool on himself.
See, that's the issue that I found with a lot of this is that if you look at, if you look at something like, sort of to your point, not necessarily the point of the article, but to your point, if you look at the at ODD in the DSM-5, this is not a physiological or neurological thing. It's a behavioral disorder, and it's oppositional defiant disorder, and it's basically just every anarcho-capitalist, like every libertarian, yeah. and they can like actually diagnose a disease for being one of those, just like you said, just like a sovereign citizen type or something like that. That most of these people are nonviolent. Most of the sovereign citizen movement is nonviolent. There are very few who actually call for armed revolution. Most of them just want to be left the fuck alone. And, they've always loved to dose the population. I mean, we know this from, again, back in the old days of MKUltra and spreading LSD on cities and shit like that. We've known that the government loves to dose its population. I'm just, again, not surprised, but a little bit, I'm disheartened by the fact that there are individuals in the world who think that doing this to children is an acceptable behavior.
Well, you know, and here's the thing. Right now, somebody could be listening to this, and they're not a libertarian. They're not, their friends told them to listen to this. Hey, man, you know, listen to this guy. You know, he makes sense sometimes. Yeah. And they're hearing this, and their statism, their nationalism, their brainwashing is telling them, so what? It's not an American kid. The kid came here illegally. The kid broke the law. He's getting everything he deserves.
This is a question that I've addressed a couple of times. Not the least of which is in my, I have a write up on why taxation is theft. And in that I say, if you believe in human rights, if you believe that the rights that are guaranteed to American citizens are guaranteed to American citizens by either nature or God, and both of them are available to you, given the Declaration of Independence, if you believe that, then you must necessarily believe that those rights exist beyond borders, that those rights exist, that logic doesn't stop at a border, and ethics doesn't stop wherever you just think, I guess based on nationality is what I'm trying to say. So I have that line of thinking, while understandable, because yes, the rights in the Bill of Rights are only guaranteed to American citizens. If you think those rights are guaranteed to you by God or by nature, then you must then accept that those rights are given to not only Americans, but also to people from other nations as well. That nationality has nothing to do with it, that this is about humanity.
Yeah, I mean, you hear that all the time. You'll hear the staunch conservatives say, our rights don't come from government, our rights come from God. But then as soon as somebody, I don't want the government telling me what to do. Well, if he didn't want to get shot, he should have listened to the police officer. Yeah, they'll say shit. What, out of one side of their mouth, they'll talk about how, you know, live free or die, or give me liberty or give me death. And then it's like, well, he should have listened to the police officer. The police officer is not a member of the government. I know police officers. They're good guys. They've signed a pledge that they'll never, if the government ever tells them to take away guns, they won't do it. Yeah, like they're gonna
sacrifice risk their
livelihood.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're gonna lose their house. They're gonna lose their house. You know, their wife's gonna leave them over their constitution.
Right, exactly. You know? This is the problem, and this is kind of the discussion that, I mean, you posted a thing the other day where you were talking about, you posted, I believe it, well, it was a meme. You said that you kind of pointed out that the difference between good cops and bad cops is cops arresting cops, right? And the fact that never happens. And I had stated that logic is number one, unassailable. And number two, it's the reason that I kind of dropped the whole bad apple idea. And someone asked me, it's like, so all cops are bad apples? And I'm like, if you look at it logically, yeah. And that's kind of the situation that we have here too. It's people just following orders, man.
Well, you know, and people who, and they really picked the worst two words to try to describe a bad cop, a bad apple, because they don't finish it. Bad apple spoils the whole bunch.
That's exactly right.
You know, so it's like, you know, you might want to try, you know, if you're out there thinking, oh, it's just a couple of bad apples, yeah, I might want to try and figure out a better terminology, because yeah,
there's a whole other half to that idiom.
Yeah. Well, and also, if it was just a couple of bad apples, the good apples would step in and stop them. But no, they hide them. They'll hide their crimes.
That's exactly right. You know, there's an incredible interview with a bunch of New York cops about quotas, and the idea that quotas are not codified, but they do exist. And this group of cops who were on this panel were basically saying, "Yeah, no, that we are encouraged to follow these unwritten rules and things like that." And this is one of the things that falls under that is the blue wall of silence. The idea that if you're a cop, you protect other cops. And this is, I think personally, it's the number one influence on corruption in policing is the blue wall of silence. If I saw a bunch of cops arresting other cops, maybe I wouldn't hate cops so much, or maybe I wouldn't think that all cops were bad apples. But that's not the case.
All right, well, let's move on from this. I'm sorry that I started with such a horrifying story. There was a couple things that you were you had on your mind, right?
Yes, that is exactly right. And I actually saw a couple of things on here. I was looking through a couple of items, and I decided to pull a couple of things that were a little bit. Well, this is the way I see things. A lot of culture wars ought to be fought on college campuses, I think. I think academia is the number one problem when it comes to the spread of, for example, we saw social justice spread. It actually spread from academia. It didn't spread from Tumblr, right? If you actually look at where things are legitimized. And so I thought I would bring up this thing. Are you aware of the FIRE organization?
Nope.
This is an organization. They exist at, I believe it's thefire.org. Let me double check that just real quick because I don't want to be wrong. Thefire.org. This is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. And what they do primarily is they look to uphold First Amendment rights on campus. And this is a story that they've been following for a while. This is from thefire.org. New York State Senate passes bill targeting student groups who indirectly encourage hate speech or boycott of U.S. allies for the third time.
What does that all mean?
Well, I'll dig into it. From the article, for the third year in a row, New York State Senate passed a bill that would prohibit student organizations at state universities from eligibility for student fees if they directly or indirectly encourage or permit, quote, intolerance, hate speech, or boycotts, end quote, against some, but not all, allies of the United States. And once again, the legislative session draws to a close without the measure passing in the New York Assembly, preventing it from becoming law. This iteration of the measure, Senate Bill S2493, attracted bipartisan sponsorship and passed the state Senate on Wednesday by a vote of 48-12. The first version of the bill, introduced in 2016 as Senate Bill S8017, which likewise passed the state Senate, borrowed language from a, quote, blacklist created at the discretion of Governor Andrew Cuomo that similarly applied to anyone who, quote, promotes others to engage in, end quote, boycotts of Israel. A number of states have also introduced laws concerning contracts with people or entities that boycott Israel, including contracts with speakers on college campuses. So this thing has...
Jesus Christ.
Yes. This thing has passed the New York Senate for the third time. Now, it's never been able to be passed into law, but this is something that the fire follows because they're interested in the rights of free expression on campus. That's their primary interest. And this, if this were to become law in the state of New York, then organizations on campus which promoted boycotts of Israel specifically, but further, this is the thing that I think is even worse than the boycotts on Israel idea, is the idea of encouraging hate speech or hate speech, right? So depending upon what one defines hate speech as, or what any one state legislature defines hate speech as, this could chill speech across a broad spectrum and could be a massive problem. And the fact that this continues to pass the Senate in the state of New York shows that there is a real push to chill free speech rights, not only on campus, but also across the board.
Yeah, I swear I saw something, and I don't know if I can look it up real quick, but I think they passed something in Texas where if a company or a business, or I can't remember what it was. I'll try and look it up. But if you boycott, if any company like boycotted Israel, like joined in the boycott, and I can't remember what the boycott's called. It's a three letter designation that, they wouldn't get certain contracts or something, or they wouldn't be able to get, renew their business license.
I've just founded something related to it, on May 2nd, 2017 from forward.com. Headline, Texas becomes 17th state to pass law countering boycotts of Israel. The law known as HB 89 charges the Texas Comptroller's Office with making a list of all companies that boycott Israel and provide the list to state agencies. Those agencies will then be barred from contracting with those companies. State pension funds are also prohibited from being invested in firms involved in the boycott, divestment of sanctions, BDS campaign against Israel. The bill passed the state house 131-0 and the state Senate 25-4. That's fucking terrifying.
I know, man. You really have to ask yourself who's in charge and what the ideology is of who's in charge. And I'm not trying to sound like some kind of crazy conspiracy theorist, but you know, if you look at like the kind of power that AIPAC wields.
Yeah, exactly.
If you just look at the kind of power, Israel, everything they do, I mean, stuff that they've been condemned in the international, they've been condemned by their own newspapers for, gets a pass in the United States, one, because, I mean, the New York Times is just basically their mouthpiece and just basically repeats anything the IDF sends them.
Right.
And two, Christian Zionism in this country, the overwhelming majority of Christians in this country, their end times theology, their end times belief
exactly.
has to do with the fact that Israel is going to rise again, that they're going to build a temple, that they're going to,
it's going to be, that's the home of heaven on earth, according to these people.
Yeah, and you know, so it's like, of course they get a pass. I mean, Jeremy R. Hammond talks about, I've had him on the podcast, and you know, he talks about, you know, I talked about AIPAC and all the special interest groups, and he's like, man, if you just look at the fact that most Christians in this country are willing to turn a blind eye to, you know, anything that they're doing. They don't even need lobby groups in Washington. They could just pretty much get, you know, consensus will let them get away with whatever they want.
I agree completely. I think what you're saying is very important, because the thing is, this isn't like pseudo anti-Semitic World Bank type argument. The simple fact is that Christian conservatism, especially in the United States, is willing to go to bat for Israel over just about anything. And that's something that's been pervasive, especially since Reagan. And I think it's important to consider that Christian conservatism specifically, but also, I mean, if you look at the influence of the Anti-Defamation League and what they're able to accomplish just by snapping their fingers, it's incredible. It doesn't have to be even, that, you know, Jews run the world or whatever. It's got nothing to do with that. It's got everything to do with the political reality of conservatism, of the political system in the United States, and the deals that we've made in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so entrenched that there's really nothing. I mean, short of just tearing the state down, I don't see anything changing as far as that goes. You know, and if New York State, which isn't shocking, I mean, I'm from New York, it's not shocking to me that would pass, you know, not get passed into law, but definitely pass the, was it the House or the Senate there?
It was the Senate.
Yeah, if it gets past the Senate, that doesn't shock me at all. I mean, it's the Zionism runs real deep in New York. I'm just very shocked that, you know, they talked about the state university system, because the state university system in New York State is vast. I mean, there are campuses everywhere.
Everywhere.
Campuses in Lake
City
Oswego.
College. City College itself is massive.
Yeah, and we're not talking about, I mean, we're talking about areas where, you know, in Western New York, where it is conservative as fuck, you know, where they, you know, they vote Republican there. It's been forever since they voted Democrat.
Right. It's the city that makes everything liberal.
Yeah, and, you know, it's, and also there's a very, there's a very independent streak, amongst a lot of the people, especially the people who live in Western New York and the northwestern part of the state. But of course, the overwhelming majority, everything that comes from the city is, you know, there's so many people in the city. I mean, there's probably more people in the city than, you know, as many people in the city as there is in the rest of the state. Not really, but you know what I'm saying.
Right. I mean, as a matter of, especially when it comes down to voting, as a matter of representation, it's insane the amount of sway that the city itself holds over the entirety of the state.
Yeah, and what I was saying about conservatism in the West, I mean, is, you know, a lot of them may be pro-Israel, but there, I think that a lot of those people also may be, you know, but there isn't a real big church, you know, church community out there. That's more just like a rugged fuck you kind of area.
Right.
And I think they would choose free speech over, they would choose free speech over, you know, this law. Well, so, you know, has to be coming from the city.
I agree.
That has to be coming from the city.
You being from there, maybe you can answer this question for me, because I was listening to, Justin Robert Young's most recent episode of Politics, Politics, Politics. And he mentioned that, sort of governing in New York is all pretty much governing with an eye toward New York City. It's all sort of governing with an eye toward the city. And with that in mind, it makes sense that these senators may even ignore their constituents. And I don't know how things are broken down, though. I don't know how things are gerrymandered in that state. But if senators are willing to overlook their constituents in favor of the city, it makes sense what Justin Robert Young said, that even the mayor of New York has a ridiculous amount of power in the state at large. Is that the case, do you think?
Well, a lot of the senators from other parts of New York always have an eye on getting into New York City politics, because that's where the money is. If you're the senator that represents Rockland County, okay, there's a lot of money in Rockland County. Let me forget Rockland County, but go up towards like Rochester, places up there, everything. The politics up there is it's going to be a little more small town. It's not going to be anything like what you can, the kind of blood that you can squeeze in New York, the kind of money that you, if you can somehow get down to New York and, move down there, get elected, or just, get on with a Schumer or someone like that, somebody who's big in the city politics. I mean, that's where the money is.
Right. So it's kind of comparable to the way that California does, where like all of the governance in California is done with an eye towards Silicon Valley and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's done to the money areas and the largest voting block areas. That's for darn sure.
That is.
So yeah, that's
awesome
horrible.
For me. Like, not awesome as a thing, but it's highly interesting, I suppose I should say. Because being from Texas, I'm more used to senators and representatives in Texas more representing what is conceived to be their constituents' interests. Of course, you and I both know that that's never really actually the case, but on the surface, they pay more lip service to the interest of their constituents.
Yeah, unfortunately, Georgia is becoming more of like the representatives down here are always looking towards Atlanta, or even, God, most of them are you can see them even in their speeches and in their rhetoric, they're looking more towards Washington D.C.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, you can see that a lot down here.
The total breakdown of federalism.
Yeah. Well, talking about free speech is just, it's so under attack. That's why I wrote a book about it. That's why I wrote a book about the college campuses.
Right. Because, and that's the thing that fascinates me as well, is that what I think happens a lot is that, if you consider like anti-SJWs and you consider the way that one went, and I really do believe that war is totally lost. There's no chance of beating SJWs at this point. The only thing that we can do is allow them to defeat themselves, which they eventually will do. But, a lot of anti-SJWs, especially online, were focusing on the wrong enemies. They weren't looking toward academia and toward the elitist kind of sector as their enemy. They were looking toward Tumblrinas. Well, Tumblrinas don't matter any more than you do. So it's... Well,
that's why my book, the first chapter of the book, is just basically an overview of, how the government has adopted so many socialist policies, and it's called Thieves and Liars. The first chapter is called Thieves and Liars, and it's just how, government has adopted so many of the tenets of socialism and, how much power they have, because, these people wouldn't have power if there wasn't a government. So you always have to talk about the government first. But my second chapter is about college professors.
Yep. That's the biggest issue.
Second chapter is about college professors. Third chapter is about the students. Fourth chapter is about Antifa. Fifth chapter is about how it's spilling out into the real world.
And that's one of the things that amazed me. I'm fascinated to read your book. I haven't yet, and I apologize for that. I've meant to forever, but I have not yet.
That's cool.
One of the things that I was amazed by was going to college. I went to college on one of the more liberal campuses in the state. I went to the University of North Texas, which is just outside of Dallas and a very, very liberal campus. And I was amazed to find that the Tumblr social justice warriors that I had already been exposed to, because I was in there on Freebler with like Jeremiah Harding and a few other people, before, the current state of things now. But I was amazed to find that the social justice warrior thesis existed in the real world and in a very real way when I went to college, because I'm from a relatively conservative area. And so to see that that was actually a thing, number one, it fascinated me. Number two, it terrified me, because it taught me that this shit exists. It doesn't matter if you conceive of it as only being online. It's real.
Yeah. Yeah, it's spilling. I mean, you can see it in Google. You can see it in the largest companies in the world. So I wanted to jump on. I found another article, and it's out of New York City. But I had Maggie McNeil on recently, and you know, she was talking about FOSTA and the sex trafficking laws that they're passing, right, to shut down Backpage and, you know, caused Craigslist to take their personals and everything. And you know, she's been a call girl for over two decades. So she knows it inside and out. She used to run a brothel, and seeing the demonization of sex work as the way it's happening right now has been something that I pay attention to, because I pay attention to that, and I pay attention to drugs, mostly because if you want to talk to people about self-ownership, the first thing you need to talk to them about, in my opinion, is about their bodies.
I agree.
That they own their bodies and they should be able to do whatever the hell they want with it, you know? And Maggie makes the point that, you know, of all the online sex workers, maybe 2% of them, you know, of the adults are being forced into it. And if they're being forced into it, it's usually not a pimp. It's usually a spouse or a boyfriend or something like that.
Right.
And she's doing great work to try to dispel all the myths surrounding.
That's incredible. Work. Those are the greatest people to talk about that topic is the people who it actually affects. And I find that I personally, the sex workers segment of the population tend to be much more libertarian than you would think. I personally would think they'd be very liberal, but the simple fact is that the effect of neo-feminism upon sex work specifically, they're so, I suppose they are far too puritanical, right? And sex work is actually demonized in the realm of neo-feminism. And so for these sex workers, I empathize as much as possible, but I really feel for them, in the way that their whole line of work has been demonized, in increasingly violent ways, I find.
Yeah. Yeah. So this, there's an article out of, Scott Horton shared it about 2 hours ago on Twitter. And when I came across it, I was like, yeah, this is something I want to talk about. So the title of it says, Queens District Attorney releases final report on massage workers' death, calling sex work degrading and humiliating. And the subtitle is, and as anticipated, District Attorney finds no misconduct in raid that led to Yang Song's fatal fall. So it basically says a redacted report Thursday by the Queens District Attorney Office on the November 2017 death of Yang Song, a 30-year-old massage worker, confirms that prosecutors found no misconduct in her death. Of course, they're not going to.
This is the woman who fell out of a window, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. This is a story that I saw. I did not read up on this. I'm very glad you brought this, because I was fascinated by it. I just didn't have the time to dig into it.
Yeah, so it goes, as it goes, according to the report, which recommends that the case be closed, Yang Song either intentionally leapt or accidentally fell from the fourth floor apartment where she was providing massage services while, quote unquote, attempting to flee apprehension by law enforcement officers as a result of her unlawful conduct, end quote. The report and accompanying compilation of surveillance footage also provides a snapshot of what an NYPD vice operation looks like and how the top Queens prosecutor understands sex work. Quote, the death of Ms. Song is sad and tragic, Queens District Attorney Richard Brown said in a statement that accompanied the report's release. Quote, I have always maintained that prostitution is a degrading and humiliating industry. So there's no volunteerism, there's no you know, she's not doing this because she chooses to.
Right.
She's chosen to be degraded and humiliated.
I've written about this. I've written about the fact that removing the subject from these kinds of situations is, in fact, in my view, the worst form of objectification. Like, if you take the person out of the sexy Carl's Jr. ad, or you take the person out of sex work, you take their personal decision making, their personal responsibility away from it, you have objectified them in the worst possible way, because you've removed all subjective responsibility for their profession, for their job, for the things they choose to do. And I make that argument in an article that I wrote not long ago, but it's kind of fascinating to me, especially from the angle of feminism, that it's like they're so against objectification, but they will objectify a person who is in a line of work that they disapprove of simply because they chose to be in that line of work.
Yeah, and it's not like they chose to be in that line of work. They absolutely had to be, you know, just look at the terminology they're using. And Maggie McNeil brought this up. She said they're using the terminology sex trafficking, and they're doing that purposely so that you can think of drug trafficking. You know, so it's,
and also children, everything's like the term sex trafficking brings children to mind. And so they're playing on a lot of heartstrings.
Yeah, so, alright, I'm gonna go on with this. In the same statement, Brown praises his office's participation in prostitution diversion programs like the Queens Human Trafficking Intervention Court. See? Talk about, it can't be something that somebody's doing voluntarily, and she certainly can't like it.
Right, they must have forced into it.
Yeah, they're definitely being human trafficking. It's definitely has something to do with human trafficking. So, quote, "My office has long been at the forefront of in helping those trapped in the sex industry find an escape through programs and assistance as an alternative to incarceration." I listen to the language in that. My office has long been at the forefront in helping those trapped in the sex industry. They need to find
there's no personal choice involved. It's automatically a victimization narrative rather than talking to anybody who actually does the job and listening to what they have to say.
And they find an escape through programs and assistance as an alternative to incarceration.
That's the big one right there. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. So, yet Yang Song's experience, as elaborated in the report, reveals the limitations of any approach that attempts to rescue sex workers by first arresting them. According to the report, Yang Song was nearly finished with a mandate from the Queens Human Trafficking Intervention Court, 5 counseling sessions at Restore NYC to resolve a September 2017 prostitution arrest when the raid took place. She had 1 session remaining, scheduled for 3 days after her death. Hai Song, Yang Song's brother, was disappointed with the report. Said the police are completely off the hook, he told the appeal. As if they're doing it, the operation perfectly, as if they can, you know, as if they can go in there and like nothing's gonna go wrong.
Yeah, almost like Waco, where it's like the automatic assumption is that the actions of the authorities were without flaw.
Yeah, well, you know, why did they fight back? Well, they fucking showed up there to kill them.
Exactly.
They showed up
right
there shooting. You know?
Yep.
I'm going to fucking shoot back too. You know? So, all right. So it says the redacted report also confirms that Yang Song filed a complaint about a violent incident to the 109th precinct in October 2016. She reported that a man presented himself as an undercover police officer and sexually assaulted her at gunpoint. A U.S. Marshal turned himself in that month after the New York Police Department's Police Impersonation Unit produced a wanted poster based on surveillance footage, the report states. He was released, however, after Yang Song selected a different man in a lineup. A subsequent DNA test found that the former marshal was not the source of the DNA in all samples taken from Young Song's clothing. The case was closed in April 2017.
That is sketchy as shit, dude. That is like...
Yeah.
That's a lot of steps.
There's way too much room for error, and there's way, and from what we know of police, they will cover up their brothers.
That's exactly right.
They are going to do anything they can do.
Yeah, I'm very suspicious of that whole little segment there. That's strange. Yeah.
So it says here, Yang Song's family and former immigration attorney also told the appeal last year that she had confided in them about being asked to become an NYPD informant, something else that led the family to believe she feared police.
This is There's something no we see with the FBI as well. Report. We see this with the FBI
all the time. So, to get into this here, the raid. The Queens Vice Enforcement Unit planned the November 25th raid on Yang Song's place of work in response to a civilian complaint on November 15th, according to the redacted report. Motherfuckers, stop calling the fucking police. Just fucking stop. Mind your fucking business.
Yep, that's the...
Jesus fucking Christ.
Well, dude, if you see something, you gotta say something.
Oh, you fucking yentas in New York. God damn. Motherfuckers. The complainant alleged that females were offering massages but were selling intimacy at the 40th Road location. Prostitution arrests have decreased in New York City since the police pledged to curb them in February 2017, yet raids and sweeps in response to community complaints have continued,
Jesus, apparently, shit.
At odds with the agency's stated goals to build trust among vulnerable immigrants. It says here, the police did not break protocol during the raid, according to Brown's team of investigation. Their activity apparently put Yang Song on high alert in the minutes leading up to her fatal fall. The report states that she brought an undercover officer into her apartment shortly before 7:30 p.m. When he exited the bathroom, she allegedly asked him, "Are you a cop?" And he replied, "No." Oh, by the way, for you fucking people that think that if you ask a cop if they're a cop, they have to say yes, you're fucking idiots.
Never been true.
Okay.
That has never been true.
How could anybody go undercover?
Right. No, if you ask somebody if they're a cop, they are absolutely allowed to lie to you. Do not fall for that bullshit.
Yeah, this is not fucking Law and Order. All right. Video shows Yang Song opening the door for him to go out and watching him walk down the stairs before closing the door. The report also states that although she was alone when she either jumped or fell, Yang Song was aware of several police officers directly outside her bedroom door. Apparently she had a camera that she could see that they were coming in, so they were knocking on the door. Concurrent video inside the apartment shows Yang Song pacing back and forth and staring at a live surveillance feed of the police in the hallway before moving out of frame.
So I don't want to interrupt too much, but this is a fourth floor apartment, you said.
Yeah, it's a fourth floor apartment.
Four floors. That's a good drive.
It's about four in New York. Most buildings in New York, it'll be about 40 to 50 feet.
Right.
40 to 50 foot fall.
It's not necessarily fatal, is it? Like, you're going to break an ankle, but...
It depends. If she lost her balance going out, she could just land on her fucking head.
Right, but that's one of the things that I'm seeing, is that there's a missing possibility in a lot of the coverage of this, which is totally understandable. You don't want to actually open the door to this possibility, but the possibility that she was fucking thrown... I'm not suggesting that's what happened. We have no evidence for that, right? But at the same time, a four floor jump is not a guaranteed fatality.
No, I mean, I know somebody who jumped off of a fifth floor and landed on his feet and broke both ankles, but I mean, he lived.
Right.
You know, and he did it on a dare too, so.
Fuck, Jesus Christ. You know too many people, man.
I grew up in New York City. People are fucking retarded. People do some stupid shit.
Yeah, it's weird to see that. It's just, if you're reading between the lines, which is always dangerous because it can lead to a lot of weird thought. But if you're reading between the lines, there's a level of suspicion to this that I think is ignored by and large.
Well, yeah, I mean, and NYPD, and believe me, I know people in the NYPD who are currently in the NYPD and retired from the NYPD, and this, they're, you want to talk about some, I mean, that's the thickest fucking blue line on the planet, probably.
Right, well, it was NYPD officers who were on that panel that I was talking about earlier. It was there were like six of them who were willing to come out and talk about it.
Yeah. So the I'll end this story on this, and then we can discuss it if you want. But it says concurrent video inside the apartment shows Yang Song pacing back and forth. I already went over that. Then she goes out of frame. Surveillance footage collected from a camera on the exterior of the building also shows what looks like a body falling through the air. A commotion ensues on the sidewalk, although the body lands outside the frame. As part of the investigation into Yang Song's death, the Queens DA pulled arrest data from the building in which she worked. According to office records, there were 43 prior arrests made at the same address. So apparently there was a lot of prostitution going on out of there. But
out of that apartment.
Yeah, this sounds... Just take it... All right, take the story on its face, okay? She didn't get thrown. She fell trying to evade.
Police.
She may have jumped. Yeah. Who the hell knows? Well, I mean, people, mind your fucking business.
That's
Come
the biggest
on.
Thing have... here is that people kept reporting this shit as though it fucking bothers or even like as if it matters to them.
I mean, do people realize that? For most prostitutes just want to be left alone. They're not calling any attention to themselves. The Johns want to be left alone because they're, you know, most of them are probably married and they're
right.
going to mind their own business and keep their head down walking out. How about you just, you know what's one way you could actually deal with this? You could go and fucking talk to them.
That's the truth as well. This is one of the things too where it's like a lot of people, we touched on it earlier, or maybe it was exclusively you, I'm not sure, but, it was mentioned that the idea that prostitutes themselves being criminalized is one of the more dangerous things you can do for them. It's because they don't trust authority then. They can't go to somebody if they've been assaulted, even. Like, because of their line of work, they're not allowed to actually protect themselves given the situation that they're in. So, One of the situations that's used that I find to be the most effective if you're talking as a statist is the idea of criminalizing the John but not the prostitute. And we don't do that here. We're very puritanical and we choose to blame I don't even want to say blame because that incites negativity. I think we choose to see the prostitute as the negative influence, and that's just not logical.
It's called the oldest profession for a reason. I mean, there's this whole, basically the state has created this whole mythology around it that none of these women, that the overwhelming majority of these women are doing it because they're forced to. They, you know, I mean, it's just not true.
They're victims automatically. They are victims of some sort of violence, which, by the way, I mean, look, I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I am, however, saying that choosing to go into that profession is not necessarily evidence of victimhood.
But yeah, you know, and even if you do want to paint them as victims, well, what other victims do you want to throw in a cage? I mean,
that's
you realize
the big flaw.
If you're going to paint them as victims, then you throw them in a cage.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense. It's illogical.
Make your choice. Like, are they victims of circumstance or victims of somebody else, or are they themselves criminals? It's the kind of thing like, I don't get arrested because my shit got stolen from me. So what's the, you're exactly right in calling out that incongruity. That's very prescient and poignant.
Well, I think we probably got time to talk about one more thing if you got something over there.
Well, I really do think that free speech issue was the most important thing I could have brought up. So if you have something that you think you really want to talk about, absolutely, you go for it.
All right. Well, let me just talk. We'll talk about this one thing, and we'll talk about it real short because I don't. Real brief, because I don't think I've talked about. I don't remember the last time I talked about anything foreign policy related. But
this is some of my favorite shit. I love foreign policy discussions.
Oh yeah, I could listen to Scott Horton's podcast all day.
Exactly.
All right. Washington Post, and this is yesterday. Or is it today? Was today? Yeah, it was yesterday. The Taliban has successfully built a parallel state in many parts of Afghanistan, report says. For those who imagine that Taliban control in some regions of Afghanistan consists mainly of men being beaten for failing to pray and girls being forced to stay home from school, a new report based on scores of interviews in those areas paints a very different portrait, but one that in some ways may be equally disturbing. Life under the Taliban's shadow government, a detailed study published Thursday by the Overseas Development Institute, describes a sophisticated system of parallel governance with commissions for each area of service such as health, justice, and finance operating in numerous districts fully or partly controlled by the insurgents. The study surveyed 20 such districts across 7 provinces. The main conclusions of the report, written and primarily researched by Ashley Jackson, are that the Taliban sets the rules in vast swaths of Afghan territory, but is more concerned with influencing people. It has largely shifted from outright coercion to creeping influence over Afghans through services and state activities. It is often part of the local social fabric, and it views itself as preparing to govern the country, not just to participate in political life, whenever the 16-year conflict ends, the report says. In many areas, the report finds Taliban representatives interact almost routinely with local government officials, aid agencies, and other groups, negotiating terms in a hybrid system to deliver healthcare, education, and other services, Taliban bureaucrats collect taxes and electric bills, and their judges hear civil and criminal cases, some traveling by motorbike between hearings.
This is the greatest thing I've ever heard.
Dude, this is so, oh my god. All right. Although the first Taliban shadow governments were established more than a decade ago, the report documents how widely they have spread despite years of Afghan and foreign military resistance. It also shows how they have evolved from using force and intimidation against local populations to building carefully run, accountable systems that address people's needs, which some residents say they feel more honest and effective than government control.
Oh my god.
The report says Afghan and foreign officials are worryingly unaware of how assiduously the Taliban has worked to exert local control, make bargains, and influence services. Today, its leaders view themselves not as insurgents, but as government in waiting, the report says.
I've made this argument to conservative family members before. I've asked them, what is the actual difference, the actual logistical difference between ISIS and the United States government? And the answer is always, there's hardly any. The only difference being that one is a theocracy and the other arguably is not. The other being the United States. This fascinates me. It not only does it go to the point of anarchism, but it also kind of supports, it kind of proves what we say about government all the time.
But about what? Go ahead, keep going.
Well, just the idea that governments are organizations defined by their monopoly on force over a certain region and believed in by people who live there. And the idea that you could have the Taliban be a government is just the mere idea of it is not, for us, I think, especially so outside of the realm of possibility and reality, because we can see objectively sort of what governments do. And if this is what the Taliban is doing, Of course, there would be an argument about the legitimacy of it as far as Western governments specifically are concerned. But as far as you and I see, this is just like any other government, really, isn't it?
It's hilarious. I mean, it's basically you have a government, the United States invaded, came in, sought to make nice with the government that was the governmental hierarchy that was against the Taliban. They became, and you know, this is so well documented. You listen to so many podcasts about this, read so many articles about this, how they've just basically abandoned the people. They've become the government that's in place right now, which is basically, you know, the U.S. another U.S. pawn.
The United States, the insurgency that is pushed and developed by the United States.
Of course. And now they're taking the money. They're keeping it for themselves. They're not taking care of the people. So what happens? Somebody who has money, and people don't realize, you know, so many people don't understand, you know, oh, the Taliban will cut your hands off for growing poppy. Shut the fuck up. They finance their, you know, spring offenses by collecting taxes off of poppy farmers to allow them to grow it. The only time they didn't grow it was in 2000, 2001, when there was one, they had a drought, and two, because of the drought, they were looking for foreign aid, so they told everybody to stop trying to grow poppy, so that they, you know, so that their dealings with foreign, the dealings with people outside who look upon heroin as a negative, it wouldn't affect them.
We also can't forget the very important point that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda both have roots in the Mujahideen. And the Mujahideen was the guerrilla organization that was funded and armed by the United States during the Cold War.
Yep. I mean, it's, when I read this, I was like, how, you couldn't see this coming? You could, I mean, this kind of thing always happens when you go in, and there, something always grows on the side whenever the United States goes in there. Yeah. There's always something in waiting.
Regime
there's
changes.
Always, there's always
regime
something
change
in wait, laying in waiting.
That's exactly right. If there's anything that the United States foreign policy has shown over the last 30 or 40 years, it's that regime change always leads to other regimes, and not necessarily regimes that we're happy to have.
It always comes back to bite us on the ass, because hopefully, eventually, you know, they're going to get the friggin' troops out of there. I mean, I don't, you know, from reading Scott Horton's book, man, I don't know when that's going to happen, and it's sort of depressing when you read the book and you see exactly what's gone on there. And
you mentioned that on the most recent episode of the Friends Against Government podcast, the idea just Scott Horton's book generally, which I haven't read yet, but I need to. I have a growing list of books I need to read.
Don't we all?
But yeah, this is one of those things that's fascinating. I am not necessarily in disagreement with the idea that elites actually want these wars to go on forever, and they will, effectively.
Yeah, and it's getting people rich. There's a certain segment of the population, the, you know, classically called the military industrial complex, that is just getting wealthy. That's getting wealthy beyond belief off of this. I mean, private contractor companies as well.
Right. You know, so. And to be clear, every podcast is everybody's first podcast, or is somebody's first podcast. And to be clear, the military industrial complex was a term that was coined by, wasn't it Ford?
It was Dwight Eisenhower.
Dwight Eisenhower, yes.
who was a general, the last president to actually wear his uniform as a president. I mean, he was in, he would wear his uniform in the Oval Office, especially when he first took office, but later, during his second term, he started to, shed that. But in his farewell address, he warned, he said that there is something growing. And exactly. he termed it, he said, beware of the military industrial complex. This is not the military industrial complex is not a conspiracy theory.
Right.
It came from a former president who was a fucking general.
Right.
And
people love to conflate the terminology, primarily I think because of Alex Jones, but people love to conflate the terminology of military industrial complex with like crazy globalist conspiracy theory, and it's two totally different things. The military industrial complex is a legitimate concern that was established, the existence of which was called out by a United States president.
Oh, and I mean, and not only a United States president, who was in charge of the European theater during World War II? I think it was Eisenhower.
I think
MacArthur had the Pacific theater. This wasn't an Alex Jones kind of guy who came up with this terminology. It was fucking former president.
This isn't David Icke talking about lizard people. Like you said, this is a former president who in his farewell address said, look out for these fuckers. They're going to mess with everything.
Well, I've said for years, when they built the Pentagon, you should have known what was in the future for the United States, because you do not build something like that and intend not to use it.
Right. I've been...
There's a reason that the Pentagon was built.
Right. I've been wanting to look into the black budget, actually. There's a... You know, not very recently, I suppose it might have been a couple of years ago at this point, but that they did they actually ran an audit, and they found billions of dollars just missing. Just absolutely.
Oh, they found trillions.
Right.
Trillions. They announced the day before 9/11, famously Rumsfeld announced that there was $2.3 trillion, missing from the Pentagon budget, just disappeared. And just a few years ago, they said that $5 or $6 trillion was just gone. They have no idea where it is.
Right.
Just,
because I remember saying on Twitter that it was like some percentage of the national debt. Like, it's a fascinating thing, and I've been wanting to write an article on it, but the problem is the research is so intensive. And so I've just kind of been slowly building up knowledge in order to write the article, probably in the next several months. But,
isn't it crazy, though?
It's amazing.
They can come out and say $5 trillion is gone, but the national debt doesn't go up. You would think that you would immediately just tack that right onto the national debt, because it's money that's gone.
Right. And even outside of that, if you could account for that money, and let's say you took away that black budget and applied it to the national debt, that is a significant chunk of the actual national debt.
I think it would make people feel a whole lot better about what you were doing up there. But since people don't, you know, since it's only seems like people like us are the ones that care about stuff like that, you know, the average person who's, you know, driving down the street, listening to their shitty music, putting on makeup at the fucking light. You know, they're not thinking about that.
Right. And that's the thing too, is that we're just all rough fucking Russian trolls. That's the thing about it is if you've seen what Eric July has been, the people who Eric July has been talking to on Twitter, I don't know what you think of him, but I personally,
he's an awesome dude.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
he's
so too.
He's an awesome guy.
But he's been talking to people, and there was one lady who said, like, apparently Eric July has an army of Russian trolls behind him, and it's just like, the fuck are you talking about?
Russia.
Yeah, but that's the problem, is that it's strange that people like us who are on the outside of, and I said this during the 2016 campaign, is that being on the outside of this dog race, not having a dog in the race, not having a, I guess, horse in the race, dog in the fight is proper, right? Not having that situation, it affords all of us a certain kind of objectivity that others don't have, simply because people are typically red team, blue team. And for us to be able to look at this and see, well, I mean, just like that, for example, this lost money is X percentage of the national debt. And if we took this lost money and applied it toward the national debt, it can make a lot of people more confident in the United States as a country. And that's just from a political science angle. Again, anarchist, right? I don't actually give a shit about that. But yeah, from the political science angle of it, it makes much more sense to do it that way. But it's just fascinating to see the way that people respond to this kind of thing. It amazes me.
And on that note, I'm going to let you go because I want to I've had a long day. I think I told you before we started recording that I was outside most of the day today, and the humidity sucks in Georgia this time of year.
Being in Georgia is it's not the place to be this time of year. Jesus.
I really wish I was at Pork Fest this week.
Right.
I think the weather's probably much nicer.
I've been seeing tweets from Pork Fest, and I am so fucking jealous. I want to be there so bad.
All right, man. You have a good night. Talk to you again.
All right. You have a great one, man. I would love to talk to you again very soon.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Have a great one.
All right, guys. I want to thank you for tuning in to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Dean for being here. Remind you about my books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. They're on Amazon and on my website. On my website, you can get them for cryptocurrency. And I look forward to coming back at you in the middle of the week with another podcast. So take care. Have a great week. And bye.